This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehius Wahib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
There could be catastrophic congestion that actually forces shipping lines to start diverting their vessels away from South African ports. We've already seen a few instances.
That's Denise Hobson, a logistic expert on the impact of a cyber attack last week in South Africa. Details are coming up. Also, Rwanda says it has killed 14 insurgents in Mozambique. The UN is calling for the opening of critical aid routes in Ethiopia's Tigray region. And the UN Children's Fund is calling for an end to COVID-19 school closures. These stories coming up on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. As Tunisians struggle to make sense of their country's turmoil, the Washington Post noted that influential voices in Egypt, Saudi Arabia, and UAE celebrated it as a blow to political Islam. The newspaper said U.S. Senator Chris Murphy has urged the Biden administration to investigate possible interference by Saudi Arabia and the UAE in the political crisis. William Lawrence, professor of political science at the American University in Washington, analyzed the regional intervention in Tunisia for VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi.
Well, they're doing that, and the Biden administration should. 3 days before the Tunisian president's actions, there was a tweet from a senior Emirati official saying that something big was about to happen against the Muslim Brotherhood in Tunisia. So there was clearly some coordination there. There's a massive social media campaign going on to present false information inside Tunisia, and tens of thousands of tweets are emanating from Egypt and UAE and sources in the Middle East. And there's a celebration in the press of those three countries of, you know, the ending of the tenure of what they call the Muslim Brotherhood, but Tunisia's largest political party, which is a Muslim Democratic Party. And so it's serious. And right at the moment where it seemed like the UAE was changing its geopolitical role in the Middle East, stepping back from the Yemen conflict, changing its approach to the Syria conflict, and moving back to its more sort of mercantile role in regional geopolitics rather than a political interventionist role, this happened. And forces in Tunisia that UAE had long been supporting suddenly are trying to take power. And I'm not so sure UAE wants to be accused of that again. And so I think it comes down to Egypt. There are unconfirmed reports that there were Egyptians at the presidency when the president and the prime minister met on Sunday just before this power grab, and that the prime minister may have been struck in the meeting. And whether or not these are true, Tunisians see an Egyptian hand in what's going on. And I'm sure that some pressure will be brought to bear on Egypt by Secretary Blinken and others to make sure that Tunisians are allowed to solve this problem without too much outside interference.
So could Tunisia slide back to a one strong man autocratic regime?
Yes, but Kais Saied's not a strong man. He was a professor teaching a basic constitutional law class that didn't even have a proper PhD or academic training. He wasn't involved in the creation of the Tunisian constitution and keeps violating it in his actions, even though that's his specialty. He has no political party. He had no political experience before coming to power. Whether he can pull off this type of strongman coup like we've seen in Egypt or with the rise of MBS in Saudi Arabia, it's just hard to imagine given who he is. But, you know, we've seen similar populist power grabs in Brazil, in Hungary, and in the United States. The Trump-Saied comparison is a valid one in that Trump tried every way he could against the three branches of government to grab power, often failed, sometimes succeeded, and tried to close down parliament and failed, right? The parliament equivalent, Congress. Saied did pretty much exactly what Trump did, and he's had more success so far. So it remains to be seen whether these Tunisian institutions and pro-democratic political culture prevail, or whether populism and opportunism and power, cynical power grabs will prevail. But Tunisia often reaches the brink and then emerges successfully, and hopefully that'll happen again.
That was William Lawrence, professor of political science at the American University in Washington, speaking with my colleague Mohammed El-Shenawi. South Africa's ports are still dealing with big bottlenecks of goods and freight after a cyber attack last week paralyzed the IT system of Transnet, the state-owned company that manages the country's container terminals. Although the government says operations are getting back to normal, the incident has caused losses of billions of rands to an economy already battered by recent violence and the COVID-19 pandemic. Darren Taylor has more.
Transnet's calling the cyber attack sabotage, which it says is being intensively investigated. It won't say more, but several IT security experts have told VOA the company could be the victim of a ransomware attack which locks computer operating systems. The criminals unlock them only when a ransom's paid. Dennis Hobson, a logistics expert at the Investec Financial Group, says few importers have access to their containers that have piled up at the ports over the past week. Consequently, he adds, South Africa's going to experience shortages of various items, including foodstuffs such as rice, for months.
From an export point of view, backlogs start to build up with exports not being loaded onto vessels and departing for the various destinations around the world.
The crisis at the harbours is happening during peak season for South Africa's citrus fruit industry, the second largest in the world. The Citrus Growers Association says fruit's still stuck in cold stores and warehouses. Hobson says the problem's far from solved.
There could be catastrophic congestion that actually forces shipping lines to start diverting their vessels away from South African ports. We've already seen a few instances recently.
That congestion has happened.
The whole supply chain essentially gets broken. There are far-reaching consequences when these type of disruptions take place within in the supply chain, considering that supply chains have been heavily disrupted for the past 12 to 18 months due to knock-on effects of the global shipping crisis.
That, Hobson explains, was sparked by the COVID-19 pandemic and the worldwide lockdowns that caused shipping to come to a near standstill last year. Many goods are already missing from South African shelves as a result of the recent looting at Durban, sub-Saharan Africa's busiest port. The harbour and warehouses were plundered, cargo was stolen, damaged, or not delivered because of the violence. Hobson says the fallout from the cyber attack will worsen an already terrible situation.
There will be a likelihood of shortage of stock on shelves. With a shortage of stock, there's going to come cash flow issues due to lost sales, cash flow cycles coming under severe pressure. It might also force some importers to consider having to air freight in critical stock just to meet demand.
He says the damage to the economy will be felt long after Transnet's IT systems are back up and running. He refers to steel imports, which haven't reached factories because of the crisis.
In the automotive sector, you could have production line stops, which will also be catastrophic, both from job loss as well as backlogs of vehicles being manufactured.
IT experts expect South African state companies to suffer more cyber attacks in the near future because they say they're not geared to prevent them. Hobson's urging the government to partner with the private logistics sector so that if state systems crash, the private entities can step in to help avert economic tragedy. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
In the latest ethnic flare-up in Ethiopia, militias from the Afar region attacked the neighboring Somali region, killing hundreds of civilians. Hundreds took to the streets yesterday in Jijiga, capital of Ethiopia's Somali region, to protest last Saturday's deadly attack. The region's president, according to Reuters, said that youths protesting the attack have blocked a vital road and rail trade artery that links the capital of Ethiopia, Addis Ababa, to the seaport of Djibouti. A UN report says 95% of Ethiopia's imports are transported via that corridor. In more news from Ethiopia, some 5,000 refugees fleeing conflict in the Tigray and the Amhara regions are expected to cross into Sudan in the coming days. The French news agency AFP now puts the total number of Ethiopian refugees in Sudan at nearly 60,000. Meanwhile, the United Nations yesterday called for the opening of critical aid routes in Tigray, warning that the region, already threatened with famine, risks running out of food supplies. AFP says access was cut off last week after the only available route for aid delivery was made inaccessible following an attack on a World Food Program convoy. The UN Children's Fund is calling for an end to COVID-19 school closures, which it says are harmful for children's well-being and future prospects. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
Schools in the Northern Hemisphere are closed for summer holidays. Elsewhere in the world, schools remain closed because of the pandemic, depriving more than 600 million children of an education. The UN Children's Fund reports nearly half the countries in Asia and Pacific have been closed for more than 200 days during the pandemic. Lengthy school closures also exist in Latin America and the Caribbean, and recent estimates show 40% of all school-aged children across Eastern and Southern Africa currently are not in school. UNICEF spokesman James Elder says these school closures are adversely affecting children's physical and mental well-being.
What this looks like, and we've learned this over the past year from the data, is that education and safety and friends and food are being replaced by anxiety and violence and teenage pregnancy. Across the globe, in all continents, we're seeing child helplines, a good precursor to understanding kids who are reporting violence, seeing often triple-digit increases.
Elder says remote learning is simply not an option for at least a third of the world's school children. He notes more than 80 million children across East Asia and the Pacific do not have access to distance learning during school closures. In Eastern and Southern Africa, he says schools in Uganda were closed for 306 days because of the pandemic, topping a list of 20 countries with the highest number of days of school closures. South Sudan comes in a close second. He adds most people in these countries have no access to the internet, thus excluding the possibility for remote learning.
If that doesn't resonate to those in power, then the World Bank does have a report showing around, their estimate is about a $10 trillion loss in earnings for this current cohort of students over time. UNICEF firmly believes this cannot go on. There is clear evidence, as you all know, that primary and secondary schools are not among the main drivers of this transmission.
UNICEF is urging all governments to reopen schools as soon as possible and not wait for the teachers and students to be vaccinated. It says the losses experienced by children are too great for them to wait any longer to receive the education and learn the skills that can help them build a better future. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The Intergovernmental Authority on Development, or IGAD, says addressing the gender gap in resource management could help prevent conflict in the Horn of Africa region. Ministers from IGAD met yesterday in the Kenyan capital, Nairobi, to discuss how to address gender inequalities and increase women's access to land, as Ruben Chama reports.
Esther Bett is a small-scale dairy and tea farmer from Kenya's western county of Uasin Gishu. In a passionate plea, she talks about the tribulations that women smallholder farmers face, including the struggle to farm land that they do not have secure access to.
Women work 80% of the lands in sub-Saharan Africa. They provide 75% of the labor. They produce the food. They take care of the land. But very little of that land that they take care to produce food is owned by those women.
Unequal access to land and property is a major obstacle in many African countries. IGAD member states, which include Djibouti, Eritrea, Ethiopia, Kenya, Somalia, South Sudan, Sudan and Uganda are stepping up efforts to ensure equal rights for women. Farida Karune is Kenya's Cabinet Secretary for Lands and Physical Planning.
In Kenya, we are beginning to ask, what can we do? What more can we do? Because our constitution is one of the most progressive constitutions in the world, not just in our continent. Yet, the percentage of women that own land in Kenya is probably about 2%. And that is why, as a country, we are currently trying to digitalize our transactions so that it will be easier to access data. So we really need to reflect.
In Africa, women are more harshly affected by land tenure insecurity due to discriminatory laws and practices, as the Kenyan lands minister explains.
It's not for lack of policy that we are struggling as a continent. So we must begin to ask the deeper questions. In our country, we have a law to document those rights. We have only just started the process of implementation, and we have found it very complex, because when you go to the communities, the men in our communities begin to want to claim more space than they should. And we include women in the community land management committees, but they still have to fight for that space, even though we have written it in our law.
Yesterday, the IGAD ministers endorsed the Regional Women's Land Rights Agenda, a framework document to enable the IGAD Secretariat to provide the necessary support to member countries in implementing gender and land projects for the next 10 years. Aya Libo Warile is South Sudan's Minister for Gender, Child and Social Welfare.
When women are not meaningfully involved in governance, their interests are usually ignored and their rights to land and resources can be weakened or lost. Although South Sudan has signed and adopted some of the major international and regional legal frameworks on the protection of women's land and property rights are yet to be ratified.
Bet says IGAD's bold move will help empower millions of women.
I think it's the best thing that can happen to women. Women are able to inherit land in Kenya only if they are married. So if you're married, the land that your husband owns is your right. So if your husband passes away, you have a right to inherit that land. But women still face a lot of challenges in terms of the customary and traditional laws, where the in-laws and the family members of the husband sometimes deny the women the ownership of that land and actually transfer the land and deny her the rights to do what she's able to do on the land.
The African Union has called for individual member states to cooperate at regional levels to address land issues and challenges through people-driven reforms in which women's rights to land are ingrained. Ruben Chama, VOA News, Nairobi.
Amnesty International says authorities in the kingdom of Eswatini must drop what it called trumped-up charges against two members of parliament and release them immediately and unconditionally. The rights group says legislators Muduzi Basidi Mabuzu and Mithan Duni Dubi are victims of a political witch hunt designed to silence dissent. Amnesty says the parliamentarians were arrested July 25th after the country sustained pro-democracy protests. A new report by the UN Office of the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs says that despite a good harvest, millions in Zimbabwe still face severe food insecurity. Adigando gives us more on the story from Bulawayo.
A report which forms part of the UN's humanitarian response plan surveys food supplies and health conditions among 4.5 million people targeted by the UN and its humanitarian partners. The study concludes that the coalition provided support for 648,000 people between January and March. These include 634,000 people who were helped to access health services, 335,000 who received food assistance, about 219,000 children who were being assisted in accessing education. The report says the UN's humanitarian response plan was badly underfunded, meeting less than 2% of the requirements having been received by the end of March. The UN and humanitarian partners appealed for US $84.9 million to mitigate the effects of the public health crisis and the knock-on effects of the COVID-19 pandemic on vulnerable people in Zimbabwe last August. The UN's vulnerability assessment, which evaluates food and social needs for rural people, indicates that the number of households receiving UN NGO support surged from 13% registered in 2019 to the current 33%. Workers say the new data represents a correct assessment of reality despite the bumper harvest touted by the government. Peter Mtasa of the Zimbabwe Congress of Trade Unions says the situation is dire given the minimum wage. He notes that it's far below the poverty datum line of around 30,000 RTGS or Zimbabwean dollars, which is about US$250 at the official market rate.
The working class is in a crisis in this country. The Zimbabwe Vulnerability Assessment Committee report indicated that 83% of urban dwellers, the majority of whom are working class, are failing to buy food, bread, cooking oil, mealy meal, and many other food items. These are people that are going to work daily, but they are earning useless wages in RTGS against an economy that is dollarized, where prices of goods and services are pegged in US dollars. Many families of the working class are now failing to pay rentals because rentals are in US dollars.
The government last week announced a wage increase of 50%, but workers have since criticized the increase as piecemeal and far from what they need. Economic analysts say that the report must take into account the window period between harvest and drying. Economic analyst Reggie Shoko says that there is a bumper harvest in some areas, but that's not the case in many parts.
There are some provinces that have actually failed to meet their minimal target of self-sustenance in terms of maize. Hence, the logistical management of the distribution of the harvest is very important at this moment in time, given the fact that certain provinces have challenges in terms of maize output, and also generally the fact that other areas are not good agricultural areas for cropping.
Shoko calls for a multi-sectoral approach to dealing with food insecurity in the country.
We will always have these challenges where people will always be vulnerable to hunger. But what we then need is now that UN, government of Zimbabwe, NGOs find a way of redistributing the major output of the harvest across so that the balance is and reduce the vulnerability of those that are already vulnerable due to droughts, due to other challenges like corruption that are facing the Zimbabwean economy.
Observers say that the narrative of a country basking in the abundance of a bumper harvest is deceptive because it fails to recognize that millions are struggling to eke a daily existence.
Here's a quick look at the action in the 2020 Tokyo Olympics. In men's soccer, Egypt's Pharaohs beat Australia 2-0 to place second in pool play on Wednesday, placing them in the quarterfinals. South Africa, on the other hand, sank again against Mexico, 0-3. The Bafana are eliminated after three defeats. The quarterfinals are Saturday. Ivory Coast faces Spain and Egypt plays Brazil. And the Egyptian men's handball team beat host nation Japan 33-29 in a preliminary match. However, Egypt's Omar Asar will not go beyond the men's singles table tennis quarterfinals after falling to China's Ma Long 4-1 on Wednesday. In Thursday's action, South Africa's men's hockey team beat Germany 4-3. In women's beach volleyball, Kenya fell to the U.S. 2-0, and the Kenyan women's rugby sevens team lost to New Zealand 29-7. And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, thank you again for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America.